We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is founder and president of FFTT, Luke Grohman. Luke, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on today, Tom. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you back. It's been a while since you've been on the show, and it's my pleasure to be interviewing you for the first time myself. So you point out that there's many signposts, as you call them. So what are these signposts indicating, and what are some of the most significant ones that stand out to you right now?
Sure, yeah. So signposts, as we talk to them, or as we talk about them, are really just fundamental developments that signify potential indicators one way or another. So when you look at the signposts these days, I think what we're really seeing is the bursting of the first global sovereign debt bubble in 100 years. The last time we saw something like this was in the immediate aftermath of World War I. And in that case, the six biggest industrial powers of the era, the US, the UK, Germany, France, Russia, and Japan, all six of them over the next 2 to 12 years, saw the value of their sovereign debt fall by 75 to 100% against gold over the next 2 to 10 years. And two of those six, Germany and Russia, hyperinflated. Germany more famously than Russia, but basically the currency went to zero in both cases. And so some of that's a political issue. That's not what I'm saying is likely to happen to places like the U.S. this time. With that said, what we're seeing is not the same, but similar setups in terms of when you take a step back in terms of how we got here. In 2000, we had an equity bubble, and policymakers effectively kicked those problems upstairs to the banking sector by creating a housing bubble. And then that burst in 2008, of course, and policymakers kicked that problem upstairs to the sovereign level by basically backstopping everything. And the challenge is that once the sovereign has backstopped everything, you have effectively what is a sovereign bubble. You have full faith and credit at a time when that is being impaired or being stretched. And so now that we have kicked the problem up to the sovereign level, there's nowhere else to kick it up to. It has to be resolved via currency depreciation, unless you think Western sovereigns are going to nominally default on their sovereign debt or their entitlements, which is highly unlikely in my view. So figure out a way to basically reduce the real value of sovereign debt, devalue the debt in real terms by devaluing the currency without freaking out the bond market. And it's a very tricky thing because those two goals are diametrically opposite goals. So we're seeing a lot of signposts pointing to A, this is the first bursting global sovereign debt bubble in 100 years. B, they are trying to set up a system or a policy of financially repressing, inflating away these debts. And I think most recently, in the last couple months, we have seen the bond market start to figure out, uh-oh, we're the sucker at the card table, the proverbial sucker at the card table. And that's not something we want to be. And so I think that's where things stand here today. And how it develops from here is dependent on a number of different factors.
Mm-hmm. So as you're talking about that sovereign debt bubble, can you talk a little bit about some of the differences, let's say abroad versus what that does to affect the population at home?
Yeah, so it depends on which country you look at. I spend a lot of time with the U.S. Number one, I'm in the U.S. Number two, the U.S. is almost 2/3 of the world's global equity markets in terms of market cap. Number three, maybe most importantly, the U.S. is the global reserve currency issuer. So basically, whatever we do is going to affect everybody else in a variety of different ways. So in terms of the U.S., really, you've got a current account deficit, twin deficits. So we're running both trade and fiscal deficits that are pretty much unprecedented in size. And historically, those deficits have been significantly externally financed. In other words, basically, the rest of the world buys treasury bonds as their FX reserve assets and finances our deficits. That has begun breaking down over the last 7 years or so as foreign central banks stopped buying our treasuries for the first time in 70 years, really. And so once you understand that the U.S. has domestic and external obligations, then you say, okay, how are these going to be resolved? It's, you know, they have obligations. These can be resolved by either inflating them away or defaulting on them. They're not going to default on them nominally in all likelihood. And so then you say, okay, Now, from here, if we're not going to default, we have internal obligations, external obligations. So our external obligations are obviously treasury bonds, and we've got about $6 or $7 trillion in foreign held treasuries outstanding. We have our defense obligations around the world, which in theory could be cut back on. In practice, probably not in any real way. And then our domestic obligations, which are usually not counted as debt. And those are very substantial. The Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, they were estimated at about $100 trillion by former Dallas Fed Chairman Richard Fisher back in May 2008. Discount rates have come down since then. The population's 12 years older. The obligations have gone up. So either the debt has gone up. So that $100 trillion is, I would take the over on that number, possibly by quite a lot. And so those obligations then come up for, you know, is it possible we could default on our external obligations? No. Is it possible we could try to inflate them away? Yes, I think we are seeing us try to do that with this serial stimulus. And while trying, and this brings up the question of yield curve control in the U.S., is ultimately, will the Fed have to, they're already doing some yield curve management, I would say, but not yield curve control. Or can we do entitlement reform, as it euphemistically is called, which is really basically breaking the defaulting on the United States internal creditors, the baby boomers, or the generation to follow my generation, you know, Gen X, where you can cut back or reform entitlements. Politically, that was probably viable up until 2008, once the Fed bailed out all the banks, et cetera. It became very difficult to politically cut back on mom and pop. And I would, some of the socioeconomic unrest we've seen in the United States and elsewhere in the West, but again, in the US, I think it's all but impossible to cut back on there. So if we're not going to default on external creditors, we're not going to default on internal creditors, we're going to try to financially repress them away, both external and internal. And that each of those poses a series of challenges to do. And those challenges, this all went from being a rapidly rising problem to being an extremely acute problem in the aftermath of COVID, because the COVID situation blew an absolute gaping hole in the fiscal position of the U.S. Mm-hmm.
So, Luke, you've been saying that the government is gaining control of the money supply. So can you give us an example of this and explain why this is really a one-way process?
Yeah, we've been saying effectively that when you look at the response to the COVID crisis, if you go back to 2019, there was a BlackRock Institute white paper written by former Fed Vice Chair Stan Fisher, two other global central bankers. And what it said was, in the next crisis, central banks are basically out of ammunition. In the next crisis, there will be unprecedented coordination between central banks and fiscal authorities. And fiscal authorities will do a bunch of spending, and the central banks will effectively monetize it, up to and including keeping interest rates well below GDP, so that the rise in interest rates does not offset the stimulative benefit of the fiscal spending. That's what they said in August of 2019. Fast forward 7 months, we had the COVID crisis. That's exactly what they began doing. So what this implies is significantly negative real interest rates. But what it also implies to your question is effectively the central banks being subjugated by the fiscal authorities. The fiscal authorities are now in charge effectively of the marginal source of credit, marginal economic growth. And we've seen that in terms of the GDP growth. We've seen that in particular, people say, well, right now in the United States, banks aren't lending, so there can't be inflation, there can't be GDP growth. And what we've been consistently pointing out to people is that's not true. Last year, bank loans to the U.S. government rose over 20% in the United States, which is to say bank buying of U.S. treasuries and agency mortgages were up over 20%. And those are effectively loans to the government at uneconomic rates, rates below where the free market would otherwise set them without Fed help. And the Fed basically grew their balance sheet by a whole bunch. So you're seeing this, basically, we've called it Chinese economy with U.S. characteristics, where you saw it start last year. And I think you're seeing it in spades now with the Biden administration, where I think the thing that first really kind of surprised the bond market this year was we're seeing this pretty decent recovery. And the Biden administration came out and said, now we're still going to do $1.9 trillion. And in the last couple of weeks, they said, well, we're going to do another $3 trillion after that. And the question is, you know, bond market's waking up to this. The question is, I think it's political. Well, can they keep doing these stimulus? And I think for as long as Biden controls the House and the Senate and the White House, they probably can, although that's not my area of expertise and some of the nuances of the political process. And then where will the bond market back up to when the Fed, if, oh, I think it's when, when the Fed is forced into explicit yield curve control, where they just say, look, we're not going to let the 10-year go over. And I don't know if the number is 2%, 2.5%, 3%. I suspect it's somewhere between 2.5%. But we'll see. Some of that's dependent on what the fiscal side does. If they come out with, you know, $5 trillion and more in stimulus, then, you know, maybe it could weather 3 or 3.5. So there's multiple levels there. But ultimately, what it speaks to is the U.S. government is effectively, through fiscal policy, driving monetary policy for the time being, driving economic growth. So that's really where they've taken control of things, or how they've taken control of things.
Mm-hmm. So, Luke, exactly as you were just mentioning about, let's say, explicit versus maybe covert yield curve control, can you give us some examples of the differences of them and why the Fed is scared to death of explicit yield curve control?
Sure. So we've called what they've been doing over the last, certainly over the last, call it 2-3 months, yield curve management, right? Where we've seen over the last, I think, 7 or 8 weeks, the Fed's balance sheet rise in excess of the stated $120 billion per month in asset growth. So they've been buying more assets over the last 7 weeks after having been buying under for a time, generally. And I think importantly for context, as they've been doing this, the 10-year yield has backed up about 30 basis points per month in February and in March. So we've taken to calling this yield curve management, or YCMs. Basically, you can infer that had they not been more aggressive, the 10-year might have backed up more than it otherwise did. I can't prove that, but if you've got the biggest marginal buyer in debt markets buying more than they said they would, you can infer that yields probably would have risen more otherwise. And I think what they're trying to do is find a level. Basically, I think they're being responsible. I think they're doing exactly what I would do in their seat, which is start trying to linearly walk rates up as far as you can and see where you hit a problem. And so we've referred to that as yield curve management. Yield curve control, on the other hand, or YCC, is an explicit hard ceiling. We're going to implement yield curve control at 2.5%. And that's what the United States did once World War II broke out in late 41. So in early 42, the U.S. Fed said, we are going to buy every 10-year treasury the U.S. Treasury issues at 2.5%, no questions asked. And that's what would happen again this time in some way, shape, or form. And so basically, that is a hard ceiling. And that is where the release valve goes entirely to the Fed's balance sheet. Whereas right now, you've got two release valves. You've got the Fed balance sheet rising faster, but you also have yields rising. Here, it would be yields stop rising, and the only release valve is the Fed's balance sheet. And as a practical matter, by extension, the dollar versus the international trade value of the dollar. So that's really the two differences between the two as we see it. And I think right now, they are in yield curve management. And I think they're likely to stay there until something breaks. And that's a function of both, not just the yield rate, but also what's happening with the other hand with the fiscal side, where the bigger the fiscal is, then in theory, the higher the rate can be before something breaks.
Mm-hmm. You were just mentioning the US dollar and let's say its comparison to the other basket of currencies. So what do you think is the path forward for the US dollar? How you see that?
I think it comes down to, does the Fed do enough or not? And because of the U.S. dollar's global reserve status, because of the amount of dollar debt outstanding, the thing that is different about the U.S., it's always been different about the U.S., is effectively, if foreign governments, if foreign central banks stop buying our treasuries on net like they have for the last 7 years, that is fundamentally a very negative thing in the long run, in the intermediate and long run. However, to the extent the Fed does not pick up the slack, the Fed does not buy enough of the ensuing overhang of treasury supply, it's actually very positive for the dollar in the short run, and it's bearish for, you know, it's good for interest rates. Interest rates go higher, bearish for debt, because basically what happens is the United States government begins crowding out global dollar markets. You see LIBOR rise, you see the dollar rise, you see short-term treasury yields rise. And so the question then is really, in terms of the dollar, is what's the Fed going to do? What's the government going to do? What's the Fed going to do? We can see the stimulus rising. If they try to do this stimulus and the Fed stands aside, does not effectively monetize enough of this debt at negative real interest rates, then it could be really good for the dollar. The other hand is if the Fed buys enough, quote unquote, which in 2020 they did, they bought more than net issuance, then I think we'd see the dollar weaken. And so I think there's this management process that is being attempted by the Fed, probably coordinated with at least several other central banks, where I think they're trying to keep the major currencies in basically a channel against each other while they are trying to reflate the global economy via global fiscal spending. keep Karelic currencies close to each other, relatively speaking. And so I think that's how we're thinking about the various levers to the dollar. But it really, in our view, comes down to, does the Fed buy enough?
Excellent. So, Luke, you've stated before that the U.S. fiscal situation is irrecoverable, barring a few Hail Marys. It seems that the Fed is really kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. If they try to raise rates to counteract inevitable inflation, the debt could become unserviceable. So what would some of these Hail Marys be? And is there any political will to ever use any of them?
You know, the Hail Marys would be more like a massive spike very quickly in U.S. economic productivity. So let's say somebody invents nuclear fusion and commercializes it and rolls it out over the next 2 years. That would make it recoverable in a big way. You'd basically have free energy for everybody anytime you wanted, et cetera. Some other type of technology breakthrough like that was deployed commercially in a very big way. And that's why I call them Hail Marys, is either theoretically possible. There's some interesting things happening in certain transportation areas, et cetera, but I don't know that it's going to arrive in a timely manner relative to what we're seeing on the fiscal side. And so it really does come down to this fiscal spend, where you're basically going to have to do a very big fiscal spend. The Fed's going to have to buy a lot of it. The real interest rates are going to have to get quite negative and just nominally grow your way out of it. And I think, you know, it's irrecoverable from the I'll become accustomed to and used over the last 40 years.
So, Luke, how could the U.S. use gold to delever the balance sheet?
Well, there's a way. It's wonkish. It's sort of technical, but it would work, which is if you look at the, I think it's the Fed operating manual or the operating manual for Federal Reserve banks. The gist of it is that if Treasury instructs the Fed to remonetize gold, basically write the value of it up, it would create a Treasury general account deposit for the Treasury, which Treasury could then spend in the economy. 261 million ounces of U.S. official gold means that every $4,000 or so in the gold price is about $1 trillion. That would go into the Treasury general account, able to be spent into the U.S. economy. So in theory, if the Treasury said, look, write the gold up to $40,000, that's $10 trillion. You could then spend $10 trillion into the economy over some period of time. You could drive nominal GDP up significantly with no commensurate rise in debt. And at the end of it, you would have, instead of debt to GDP at 130%, it would be, I don't know, 80%, 70%, 60%. You could sort of set it wherever you wanted it to based on how much you wrote the gold up and then spent into the economy and made some assumptions about multiplier effects of that stimulus. But it could be done. I think it's a last ditch thought, but it's out there in terms of possibilities.
Mm-hmm. So what is the foreign held U.S. treasuries as a percentage of the market value of U.S. official gold? What is that number currently and what does it point to for you?
Sure. So it's a number we've looked at historically as almost a PE ratio for gold, because again, the U.S. is a global reserve currency issuer. Historically, the U.S. market value of U.S. official gold as a percent of foreign held treasuries outstanding has been, before 1989, it was never below 20%. So basically, U.S. official gold was collateralizing 20% or more of the foreign held treasuries outstanding. That number fell to 4 or 5% at the lows. It's probably 6% maybe today. At the highs, when there's significant concern about the dollar, as we saw in 1979, 1980, that number was at 133%. So that to me is a gold bubble, when every foreign creditor could show up in theory that's holding a treasury bond, redeem the entire face value of that treasury bond for U.S. official gold, and the U.S. still would have had 33% of its gold left over. So right now at 6, it was never below 20% prior to 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down and we became a unilateral power. And it was as high as 133%. So I look at it as, okay, it's at 6% today. Just to get back to the floor, the long-term floor would require over a 3x increase in the price of gold. So getting close to $6,000 an ounce. And then at the high end, something like $40,000 an ounce. If you were in a 1980 type situation for gold, that would probably require the paper market to break entirely effectively. But that's what you would be looking at in terms of the ratios that, as I've looked at, as a sort of a historical PE ratio for the gold market.
Mm-hmm. So, Luke, as we know, the way the Fed measures inflation, we're not really seeing the type of inflation that we've seen maybe in most commodities as most people would see it. So what are your thoughts as to the inflation deflation debate from here?
And this is where we've said before, where the Fed's trying to ride two horses with one rear end. It wants inflation, but it doesn't want the bond market to react to inflation. You know, basically wants inflation, but it doesn't want the dollar to fall. And it can't have both. And so I think ultimately the inflation deflation debate, to me, I think ultimately we're going to get inflation. I think we're having inflation. I think it really depends on what the Fed does. Anytime the Fed's not doing enough, we're going to have deflation. They don't buy enough treasuries. We're going to see rates rise. We're going to see the dollar rise. Once the dollar starts rising, everything else is going to start to fall, and we'll get that deflation. The challenge in this, and this is why I think we're going to get inflation, is that this is the first cycle in at least 40 or 50 years, and probably more like 80 plus years, where the dollar rises too much. If rates rise too much, the U.S. government will nominally default. In other words, yes, if the Fed stands back and doesn't do enough, we'll have deflation. If the Fed continues to stand back and not do enough, the U.S. will default, and so will a number of other sovereigns. And that's where things at some point in that continuum get very weird, because at some point when governments start defaulting, government debt effectively backs their currencies. So if the government starts defaulting on sovereign debt, the currencies eventually start weakening, and then you get inflation. So it ultimately really comes back to, in the near term, is the Fed going to do enough? Are they not? A lot of that filters into what's the dollar do, and then that filters into inflation. So really, I look at people looking for sustained deflation are effectively making a bet that the U.S. government's going to effectively default, that they're going to stand aside. And because the biggest debtor in the system is the U.S. government, and they're the reserve currency issuer. So sustained deflation is going to be a choice by the U.S. government to effectively move towards defaulting on either its external obligations, its internal obligations, its defense obligations, or some, when you look at it from a real politics standpoint, there's really any chance of that happening. So I think we're in a new inflationary regime as you see the government increase control over monetary policy, economic growth, probably with fits and starts of deflationary episodes. But I think we've really, in the aftermath of COVID, I think we've really swung from the trapeze of deflation or disinflation towards a more inflationary regime, as governments all are in kind of the same boat, which is they need to inflate away this debt.
So how does monetary velocity play into that for you? Do you think it's as important as some people say it is?
No. I think it's interesting. I think conceptually it's a huge deal, but where I have a problem with it is as it's measured is it's MV equals PQ, right? So we've got M is money supply times V, velocity of money equals prices or inflation, and Q is real GDP. And so M, money supply, we don't even know how to measure that properly. And Jeff Snyder at Alhambra has done a bunch of good work on that. We don't know what the real money supply is. Okay, so we don't know what M is. V is our plug. V is what we're trying to solve for. P, price, inflation, we know is being systemically undermeasured as a matter of political policy. And you ask any number of veterans in Washington, they would tell you, we do it, everybody does it. So P is systemically undermeasured as a matter of policy, because if it's overmeasured, then the bond market will respond. And it's a matter of national security to tend to the treasury bond market. So that's why they undermeasure P. And then Q, we don't really have a great feel on how to measure that either. It was easier to measure when we were this manufacturing economy 50 years ago, and it was sort of, you know, here's how many widgets. But now when you start measuring things like, you know, the productivity you get from an iPhone, or what's the GDP of Excel spreadsheets, and how much GDP, they don't have a great way to measure that. So the problem I have with velocity and saying, well, we're not going to get inflation because velocity is on its lows is, you know, we don't know M, we can't measure M right. We undermeasure P on purpose, and Q, we don't know how to measure. So V, it's an exercise in garbage in, garbage out of a model, in my view. And now I do think somebody who's made a really interesting point as it relates to velocity is Professor Richard Verner, who's broken down the economy into the real economy and the financial asset economy, and broken down the velocity components of that as well. And so if you said the velocity of the real economy is low, yeah, that makes sense to me. The velocity of the asset model, you know, the velocity of assets is the NASDAQ. It's the S&P. It's home prices. It's Bitcoin. There's no problem with velocity in any of these things. So I think, you know, whether you look at it as how you measure it, okay, then you can make a case. Yeah, real velocity is low. Asset price and velocity is high. Where does it net out? But from a headline perspective, I just think it is really a marginally useful metric because of where it's sitting in that calculation.
very interesting. It's almost like there's too many moving pieces for it to be very meaningful at this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, when you're trying to undermanage inflation and you don't know M and Q, what's a V? I don't know. You know, I would just as soon tell you that V is the price of the NASDAQ. But it doesn't seem like they're having any problem with that, right? Or, you know, V is the, you know, if velocity is so low, why are trading volumes so high? Well, you know, let's look at trading volumes from year 2000 to year 2021. Are those falling? Or are they rising? Home prices, are they falling? Are they if velocity is so low, where's that coming from? And so at the very least, it suggests there's a bifurcation of the measurement of velocity that needs to happen between real economy and asset price economy. And at the very most, it suggests the whole velocity as derived from MV equals PQ as an exercise in garbage in, garbage out.
Excellent. So Luke, there's another really interesting idea that you've put forth, and it's that Bitcoin is creating a price target for gold. So can you explain why this is and why it's so instructive for the gold market?
To me, I was having dinner with a relationship of mine probably almost 4 years ago now. He was one of the biggest gold traders in the world. And we had been introduced shortly before. We talked a bit. This is our first time meeting in person. And this person said to me, you know, this was late summer of 2017. So Bitcoin was starting to do its first, you know, run up to whatever it was at that time, you know, 10,000 or 12,000 on its way to 20,000 before it turned back. Just doing what gold would be doing if it didn't have the gigantic paper market attached to it. And the paper market primarily being the unallocated gold market centered in London. So to me, Bitcoin stock to flow ratio is, I think, only marginally higher than gold's right now. That'll change in future halvenings for Bitcoin. But it really shows you, I think, directionally what I think will eventually happen to gold whenever basically a political decision is made to allow the wind down or to wind down of the unallocated gold market at central banks, whether it's others, where, and in the private market where you're seeing these physical volumes. And the price is really not responding, and there's physical buying, and it takes off like a scalded cat. So the difference is that Bitcoin does not have it's not a centralized market like gold, centralized in London, where there's the unregulated expansion of paper derivatives. And so, you know, if people want to buy $100 million of Bitcoin, the price of Bitcoin is going a lot higher. If someone wants to buy $100 million of physical gold, it's probably going to take them a month and a half, 2 months to source, is what I was hearing as recently as a couple months ago. If someone wants to buy $100 million of gold, credit gold, they could be done in 5 seconds. And the challenge is that historically, that's how that's been done. I'm long gold. Well, not really. You're long credit gold. You're long a promise of gold. And you and 100 others or 1,000 others, we don't know, own that same amount. And it's that expansion of those promises on the same bar of gold that has driven a big portion of the gap in performance, in my view, between gold and Bitcoin. So ultimately, you know, the view of Bitcoin being a directional price target for gold is just based on a view that if something's unsustainable, sooner or later, it won't sustain. And, you know, by the thing that's unsustainable is this unallocated paper gold market with completely unregulated expansion of leverage over time is at some point unsustainable. Now, the question is that's a political question. And that is really, you know, there's lots of people who could break that market really at any point in time. It wouldn't take that much money in the grand scheme of things. So it's a political question, not a market question. And so if it happened tomorrow, I wouldn't be surprised. If it happened in 5 or 10 years, wouldn't be surprised about that either. Mm-hmm.
So we've recently seen that the big banks are dramatically decreasing their short position in gold. Could this be an indicator of the start of that, Luke?
Maybe. You know, I'm always reticent to say this is it just because it's sort of like, here in the States, and it's Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football where she keeps teeing it up for him and then pulling it away and he goes flying. And that's kind of been the story for gold. I've been involved with the market for 12 years, and it's been, you know, a number of times that that's happened. Mm-hmm. I do think something that is of interest, it's a bit of a splinter in my brain, if you will, is this the net stable funding ratio changes for the bullion banks as it relates to gold as part of Basel III. That was supposed to go live June 28th of this year. I believe they pushed it out to January 2022 for the UK. And last I saw that it goes live here in the US in July 1st. And again, I'm not a legal guy, so take it with a grain of salt. But to my tourist eyes, the language very much seems to read like a mandated wind down of some portion of the unallocated paper gold market, primarily in London, where it's much more expensive for these bullion banks to hold unallocated or paper gold as opposed to allocated or physical gold. And so if the net stable funding ratio goes through, particularly in the UK, if it does what it looks like it's intended to do, which is force an unwind of some measure of paper gold, then it's very conceivable that you could see a real response in the gold price as it becomes more physically driven. And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you're in a situation where you need some sort of risk-free asset with a floating face value that can rise enough to delever or create an increased asset base or delevering mechanism like we talked about before for sovereigns, but it could also on a bank balance sheet do the same. I mean, if the bullion banks hold a bunch of physical gold and the price goes up a bunch, that's effectively a huge capital increase for those banks. And that then could put those banks in a better position to buy sovereign debt at very uneconomic sovereign debt rates. So you can see clear to the reason why they might try to unwind the paper gold market to let the price of gold rise. We've long been saying that it's actually in the interests of the United States and other sovereigns for the price of gold to rise significantly for the first time in a long time. It's just one of those things where I've just been in this market for so long. I've seen so many of these, you know, this is it. This is definitely going to be it scenarios that I'm reticent to say this is it. But it is an interesting potential setup. You know, for me, I'm not really trading around it because I don't have any political insight into it. I'm just saying I own my gold. I still like gold. It's going to happen at some point, you know, tomorrow or 10 years. I don't know.
Absolutely. So another one of these kind of, let's say, signposts that you recently tweeted about was that when gold stops going down with the TLT, it equals game on. So why would that be as well, Luke?
I think because in short, it effectively suggests that even with rates rising, real rates are falling. Is basically what that message would be from the markets. And so what you've seen, we saw real rates in the U.S. bottom in August of last year, -1.1%. They've bounced off the lows. And in particular, in the last couple of months, they've been relatively stable at the 10-year. I think they've turned positive at the 30-year in theory, or gotten close to it. But at the 10-year level, they've sort of been bouncing around. But what we've seen is gold prices selling off with rises in nominal interest rates. And then in the last 2-3 weeks, gold's been relatively sticky as interest rates kept going. And so it was too early to get too crazy with it, but ultimately that's the message. If you see a situation where TLT is going down, in other words, interest rates are continuing to rise, and gold is either not going down or actually going up, the implication is that real rates are either already getting more negative or inflation is picking up, or are expected to do so. And that's something we saw in the 1970s, is people say, well, gold can't rise with rising rates. Well, that's not true. We saw it from 71 to 79. Rates went up and up and up, and gold went up and up and up. And the issue was that inflation was rising faster than rates were. So that's really the message of a world where GLD is rising as TLT is falling. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So as a portfolio manager that reviews many different industries, Luke, what kinds of criteria do you have for making investments in the gold space?
You know, for me, it's really, I come at it from a top-down perspective, a macro perspective, and it really starts with what's going on with the sovereign debt side. And so that to me is thing number one to get right. And it's probably thing number two, thing number three to get right. It's, I think, the most important investing metric possibly of our lifetime, certainly, I think, of this cycle over the next 5 to 10 years. So that's thing number one. In terms of boiling it down then to some of the mining companies, I don't get into very many specific names. The thing I do focus on and encourage clients to focus on when they get more granular is the jurisdictional, the rule of law. You want to make sure that you own properties or companies that have properties in jurisdictions with a tradition of property rights and rule of law so that you aren't wrong for the right reason. You would hate to wake up and see gold at $5,000 or something, and the country in which your mine is operating or your company's mine is operating has been appropriated by the government. And then I think the thing that you have to then look at after that are just stewards of capital. There are certain management teams that have been better stewards of capital over time than others. And, you know, I don't have all those in front of me, but those are really the things I look at, which is the big thing in terms of owning gold for me is the fiscal situation. And we've seen this throughout history over and over and over. It's been a long time since we've seen this in Western sovereigns and in particular in the United States. And there's really only three ways out of this. You either default or restructure. you financially repress or inflate it away, or you hyperinflate. And if we take away the political, you know, the reality that politically it's highly unlikely that we're going to see a default or restructuring of U.S. debt, then we're going to get some sort of financial repression, inflation, et cetera. You know, so that's really where I shake out on it.
Excellent, Luke. As we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience?
No, that's, I think, pretty good stuff to touch on for the day. You know, people are more interested in following what we're talking about. I've got a very active Twitter feed at Luke Grohman, and you can check us out at fftt-llc.com for our website and more information about what we're up to.
Tell our listeners that there's a couple different levels of what you offer at the fftt-llc.com.
Yeah, absolutely. Our research product offerings are institutional, high net worth, and we also have a retail facing product as well. And so it just depends on where their interests lie. Publish a 12 to 15 page report every Thursday. That's our flagship product. That's very in depth. And we do a 10 most interesting things piece on Fridays that ends up being about 18 to 20 pages that are just 10 different of these signposts and how they either support or refute things that we may be thinking, or, you know, it tends to be a little bit more of a, I won't say esoteric, but a little bit more assorted in terms of things that just caught our attention and were interesting that either really fit or really don't fit a lot of times in terms of either our narrative or somebody else's narrative, and kind of explore some of those themes in a quick, succinct, bullet pointed fashion. So those are the different things we offer to our clients.
Excellent, Luke. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks for me on, Tom. It was great talking.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.